Hello and welcome to the Come Fly With Me podcast, where I discuss dream holiday destinations and career plans with my guests. I'm your host and pilot, Kenneth Fairweather, and today I'll be talking with musical theatre director and lecturer, Sean Aquilina. Also a singing teacher, musician, podcast host, performer, author, and journalist, Sean has an impressive list of accolades to his name. Born on the east coast of England in a town called Great Yarmouth, Sean has lived in many places since, including London, where he moved for school at the age of 13. His career has taken some interesting turns, starting as a child performer before moving into journalism and eventually returning to his roots of musical theatre. Currently a lecturer in musical theatre at Anglia Ruskin University, he has a book coming out in October entitled Musical Theatre for the Female Voice: The Sensation, Sound, and Science of Singing, and has recently finished recording the first season of the podcast Empty Chairs at Empty Tables, with the second season due to commence in September. Join me as we take a look into Sean's early life and music career and discover what specifically Sean wants to see while in his dream destination, India. It was an absolute pleasure talking with Sean. I hope you have as much fun listening to the conversation as I did being a part of it. And as always, enjoy the ride. Welcome to Check-In, Sean. Where are you planning to go today?
Thank you. I am planning to go to India to start my sort of countrywide journey.
There's a train journey called the Island Express, which goes to Kanyakumari. So maybe that could be a good journey.
I would love to get on the Indian Railways because I like trains anyway. And I think it's a great way. I like to see scenery while I'm sat down, and it can just sort of pass me by. And I can enjoy it as it passes by. And so I think, yeah, train journey would be fantastic, especially if they've got some nice food on the train as well, because one of the things I'd really want to go to India for is for the food and all those, you know, delicious smells and flavours and those wonderful colours, things like that.
Have you had much Indian food in London? There's obviously a lot of nice stuff.
I've tried to get to a lot of good restaurants. You know, I think Dishoom is a lot of fun. You know, they're a chain now, but you know, they've got this wonderful old kind of 50s Bombay cafe feel to them, and I liked it so much that I got their cookbook, and I've tried to recreate some of it at home with the help of my local sort of spice shop. And there's an Indian guy in there who said, oh yeah, you don't need that, you can just use this instead. Oh no, you don't need that in the recipe, just use this instead. So a bit of guidance, and that's great, because you know, I think we all just associate it with, you know, strong, more English curries, but actually the depth of flavor you can get into some of those dishes, you know, it layers up bit by bit, the herbs and the spices that go in there. Yeah, I think it's great.
Have you tried their breakfast or their dinner?
I love both. In fact, for Christmas Day, I recreated an Indian breakfast, a sort of Indian breakfast, by making some homemade naan breads, which are not that difficult to make, and then made like a sausage and egg naan breakfast roll. So it was kind of the best of British and Indian together. It was so good. I optimistically ate two of them and then wasn't hungry for the rest of the day, including Christmas dinner, which I still managed to force down, but I really didn't need it after I'd had that breakfast.
In the 80s, on the island of Great Britain, just under 5,000 miles or 7,000 kilometers from India, Sean was welcomed into the world.
I was born on the east coast of England in a little town called Great Yarmouth, which was a big seaside town back in the day, back in the sort of 60s and 70s. But by the time I was born, slightly later, it was one of those seaside towns that was suffering a bit because tourism had dropped off. And I was there for about 13 years or so, and then moved to London because I started working professionally in theatre. So I went up to London to be in my first show and to go to school subsequently, and then I stayed there till I was about 18-19 years old, by which point some of my family had gone south, so I moved south for a while and I stayed there, and then I went back to London about 10 years later and then I moved again a few years after that. So I've been around the country a bit.
Was that first show, was that Oliver, was that the production
that's right with? Yeah, that's Cameron McIntosh brought Oliver back to the London Palladium in all around 1995, 96, somewhere like that. And I actually auditioned for it when it was coming back and I didn't get in. So I went back and auditioned I don't know, 6 months later or something like that. And I was successful second time round. And so, so went into the show. We started rehearsing around, I don't know, February 1996. And then we were into the show about 6 weeks later.
Very cool. And do you have a musical background in terms of, are your parents or any of your family members into musical theatre?
Not really. I was a bit of an odd one out. My granddad, who was also around Great Yarmouth, had theatrical links because he used to sell tickets for the local theatre, from his little shop, his seaside shop in Great Yarmouth. So, and you know, he used to have all the posters and see some of the big names of the day coming to play in the theatre. So there was that side of it, but no one was really a performer. No one sang or played or acted or anything like that. I guess I was the first person to do that. And I was introduced to that by my primary school music teacher. You know, I think we all need that one person who just says, "Hey, why don't you try this? Give this a push. You might be good at that." And that was who did it for me, and that set me off on the road.
Was that Sylvia Young School?
Well, that's where I went later. So if you were a kid from outside of London and you were performing in Oliver, you couldn't go to your regular school because you just couldn't be in two places at once. So what we used to do is, those of us who were outside of London, we went along for our day schooling at Sylvia Young's, which was in Marylebone at the time. They've moved now. They've moved to a much bigger school. And then what a lot of us found is that, hey, we really like it here, so we're going to try and stay on. So once I'd finished in the show, I auditioned for the school, and then I stayed on in the school for about 3 years, years 9, 10, 11, which is 14 to 16 over here. And that was a big part of my training, because from Monday, Tuesdays and Wednesdays were just academic subjects like maths and science and English, but Thursdays and Fridays were wholly given over to vocational training and to dancing and singing and acting and speech work and all that kind of stuff.
A nice balance of things at the school.
Yeah, it was a nice balance, but it was also, you know, it was quite an intensive training at an early age, and professional performance as well, because they used to get us out doing shows, doing cabaret performances and things like that. And there was an agency attached to the school, so you went up for auditions for TV work and films and theatre.
Now that we've heard about Sean's early life, let's get to know about when Sean found his calling. This is a final boarding call for Sean Aquilina. Sean, your flight to India awaits. When you moved to London at 13, was that the sort of the point that you knew you wanted to pursue this as a career?
Yeah, I think that's what I was feeling at the time, and certainly once I moved to Sylvia's as well. Obviously, a lot of young people want to do that, and our views sometimes change as we get older, and we want different things. But at the time, yeah, I think musical theatre was it for me.
Who is the musician that you look up to the most?
Well, I mean, as a composer of musical theatre, it's always been Stephen Sondheim, who died just recently. I think his music has always been the stuff that's inspired me the most, that I've most wanted to work on, to sing, to direct. I think his music is clever and moving. You know, it's of the heart and of the head, and you know, it says really important things. And his shows work. You know, they're really, really good shows. They work in front of an audience. They're very moving. And yeah, I just love his stuff.
I remember previously you've mentioned you listened to My Way in a record shop, and that really
That's
sort
right.
of inspired you.
Yeah, back when record shops were more of a thing than
Yeah.
they are now. When we used to go in, and there used to be listening posts, and they'd have up to four, maybe even five CDs there that you could sort of go through and listen to. And I remember there was a Frank Sinatra CD on there, and I must have been, I don't know, 15, 16 at the time. And I looked at it and I thought, well, I've heard of this guy a lot, you know. I think he'd only just recently died. And I thought, well, yeah, well, let's listen to him and see what all the fuss is about. And the first track on the album was My Way, and I was just blown away by it because his voice was stellar, and the interpretation of the lyric, which is what, you know, everyone says about Sinatra, his interpretation was just second to none. It was feeling in every word. And Yeah, and that set me off and on that kind of music, which I really enjoyed and still do enjoy listening to. And I even sang with a big band a couple of times, and that was a thrilling experience to have that massive sound behind you. I really enjoy that stuff.
Is the interpretation of the lyric, is that something that I guess you notice in maybe prospective students that maybe makes them stand out? You probably see a lot of people with very talented singing voices, but is that interpretation something that makes them stand out?
Absolutely. It's so important. What turns someone from being just a good voice into a proper artist if they've got something to say, something individual, something new, that they show you through the way that they're giving you meaning in every word and a specific meaning to every word. And it's really hard, because there's so much to singing technique to begin with. To then go, okay, now that's just the foundation. Now you need to do all this stuff with words as well. And it's difficult for young performers because as kids, they're not really expected to think about that. You know, they're supposed to give some kind of meaning and performance, but you haven't got the life experience to do it in the way that an adult has. And that's how they'll be judged once they get out into the business. It'll be what they communicate through their lyrics, through their interpretation. So yeah, that's a big one for us.
What are the key things in terms of that interpretation that maybe you do in your own performance or that you would suggest to somebody that's trying to improve that?
I would suggest make sure you go in stages. Make sure you know the literal meaning of every word and every sentence and every phrase, and then you know the subjective meaning of every word. So what does it mean to your character? You know, when they're singing a line from a song, you know, if you're going to sing "And now the end is near," what does that mean to your character? Is that because they're nearing the end of a long life, nearing the end of a kind of middle length life, or just the end of a particular period in their life? So you need to know that in order to express it. And then you need to dig out the meaning and make sure that you're communicating that. And I think you need to do it with a bit of humour. I think there are other writers who have said, you know, the number one thing they look for in actors and performers is a touch of humour. And that doesn't mean making people laugh. It means a kind of an attitude towards life, a lightness of touch, a good-natured sense of humour. That's what I'd be looking for.
And are there any musical theatre shows that you think this is done particularly well?
I think there's a lot of shows that have this. I mean, I think Little Shop of Horrors has a lot of good humor to it. Book of Mormon is obviously phenomenally successful. But even among, you know, the more serious ones, if you go and watch Sweeney Todd, you know, which is about a man who's kind of gone so crazy at the injustices done to him that he starts cutting up his clients and turning them into pies, into meat pies to serve the public. That's a very gruesome and kind of horrid premise, but the show itself is done with such a light touch and with a sense of humour. You know, you can't help but sympathise with him.
Much like Frank Sinatra, Sean has lived life his way. As we take off into the sky, Sean talks about the path he has paved in musical theatre and the decisions that led him there. And maybe by listening to some of Sean's insights, you too will decide to live life your way. So come fly with us, and let's fly. Let's fly away. When did your music career start to pick up momentum?
Well, there's a big break for me because after having been a child performer, I fell out of it for a good sort of 10, 12 years. And I went off and did a completely different career in radio journalism for a while. And then I had this revelatory moment where I thought, no, I really should be performing and singing. So I went back to it and I had to go and study again. And I went to the Royal Academy of Music and I studied there and I spent 2 years there on the classical side. And then after that, I just started getting work. And I initially got work singing with a big symphony chorus called the Philharmonia Chorus, who are based in London. But I performed with them across many different cities in Europe, as well as in London. And then joined opera companies as well, like Opera Holland Park and Northern Ireland Opera, and would sing with them. And it built from there. And I think then, at a point a few years down the road, I then faced a choice between going and singing for an even bigger company for a summer contract or going and teaching for a year for a very prestigious musical theatre school. And I opted for the school because I'd been in rehearsals a couple of months previously and I'd really missed the experience of being with students. So that's where things started to diverge for me, and my priority became teaching and working with students rather than being the performer myself. I felt I'd done enough as a performer to satisfy what I wanted to do. As it turned out, teaching led to directing, which has opened up a whole new creative chapter for me, because now I get to have an even bigger kind of creative input into a production and see how it goes. And that's been really rewarding.
Was the first place that you taught music, was that Guildford, or was there somewhere before that?
So I taught, the first higher education place I taught at was actually Winchester University, because they had a teacher who'd gone off sick and they needed some cover short notice. And that was the first time I went back to the musical theatre world, having been in opera for a number of years. And I loved it because it was going back to my roots. It was going back to what I'd done at Sylvia's. And then after I taught at Winchester, then I got a job with the Guildford School of Acting, which is, you know, one of our top training places. And I was there for just over a year as one of their singing teachers went on maternity leave. And that was great. And, you know, I loved it there. And they've got great students and great facilities. And we had a real ball working with musical theatre students, actor musicians, actors, undergrads, postgrads, you know, a real mix of people.
You then moved to Anglia Ruskin University after that. Is that correct?
It was a couple of years later. In between, I did some... I started teaching at other places like Arts Ed, which is another one of our big schools, and Lane Theatre Arts, and a couple of other universities as well. Because a lot of that kind of work is you're employed on more of a freelance basis, because you come in and you teach maybe a class or two per week and then you go off. They don't need you full time. But then I did pick up a full time job in January of last year, 2021. At Anglia Ruskin University, who are based in Cambridge. And so now we've got a musical theatre course, which is still quite new, still quite young, and we're building. And we've just had a really fantastic production of Urinetown, which we finished a few weeks ago, which I was really proud of. I'm proud of all the students who sang in that and performed in that, and the audiences loved it. And we'll go on to the next one in September.
Could you talk a little bit about your training in opera at the Royal Academy of Music?
Yeah, that was difficult for me. I went from being a very good journalist to being a student again, and a student who was, pretty low down in my class, really, because everyone else had years more experience on me, even though they were younger than me. A lot of them have come from doing 4 years of undergraduate study in singing, in classical singing, and I'd done no years of undergraduate study. So that was a difficult mental shift. I was just lucky that I got a fantastic teacher. His name was Alex Ashworth, and he was patient and brilliantly knowledgeable and supportive and encouraging. And he really taught me the structure of singing that I pass on to my students, which was and is an absolutely sound physicality and healthy way of singing that is produced by the wish, the desire to communicate. And it's that desire to communicate which colours your singing and makes you an interesting performer. And so, you know, although I went to the Royal Academy of Music, in many ways, I really went to Alex. I really went to Alex for many years. There were, of course, other classes and other really useful and really strong classes. But in terms of, you know, learning to sing, that's what it was about.
We've discovered a bit about how Sean made the move from performing to teaching. So now let's have a listen to what his role as a lecturer in musical theatre entails. In terms of productions, is it two main productions that you have each year?
So for me, this year there was two, because I directed Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella in what you'd call, I suppose, the autumn winter term. And then you're in town in the spring. There are other productions for the course. There are other directors who come in and do stuff. Next year, I'll do another two, maybe even three, depending on time and how much my brain can cope with. I don't know if I can cope with directing two productions at once, but I might give it a go. So yeah, but definitely at least two, maybe three productions next year.
How have you found the transition from performing to directing?
It's been really interesting. It's a steep learning curve. Because suddenly, you know, when you're a performer, you can look at your own role and you can really focus on that and you know your stuff and the requirements are, make sure you know all your music, all your lines, be generous to other performers on stage, things like that. Listen to the director, listen to the music director or conductor. Whereas the director, I've got an overview of everything. And that goes, okay, what is this piece about? What do these characters want? How do I communicate that to a cast in order so they can communicate it to an audience? What kind of design am I going to have in my set? How am I going to get that? What space have I got? What have I got in a theatre in terms of lighting and sound? It's a whole world of stuff to think about. And you have to work with different teams. You know, I have an MD that I work with. I might have a choreographer. I've got my cast. I've got my theatre manager. I've got my stage manager, my lighting designer, and people who are buying me props, getting them delivered, all sorts of things. So it's much more involved. And for me, you know, my priority as a theatre maker was always telling a story and making sure it was clear to an audience, a story with a point that's emotionally moving, that you get that across to an audience. And I used to do that purely through singing and acting. And now I have to do it through my cast and my design and my staging and well, not just mine, you know, everyone's, but take the lead on that and direct it. So it's been really good. And I've tried to read up about, other directors, what they say about it and watch some videos and things like that. But ultimately, I think you just have to do it. You just have to get on and do it. And that's how you learn.
Sounds very busy.
It is very busy. It just stays busy. But I remember, you know, I'm a big fan of Seinfeld, and they used to talk about their writing process. They had a whiteboard in the writer's room, and they might start the week with six or seven problems on a whiteboard. And they just knew that day by day, one of those problems would get crossed off and solved, and then another one, and then another one, and maybe by the time they came to shoot it, there'd be one left, and something would happen in rehearsals, and they'd tick that off as well. So I think you have to trust the process. You have to be involved and be active and proactive in the process, but also trust the process and the people around you. And that's one of the things I picked up from Sam Mendes that he said in a video. If you don't, you know, as a director, you're a fool if you don't use the 12 or 20 other imaginations in the room with you to get the work done. And that seems to be a theme in good directors, that like, well, you don't have to do it all. Trust the people you're working with. Give stuff to them and see what they come up with.
So be a good delegator and then...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, don't feel... I think I felt responsibility to come up with everything, but actually it's probably more effective to go, this is my problem, how are we going to solve it? You know, give me some ideas, show me something, and then go from there.
Once the production's finished, is there a chance then for you and your team to reflect on the production and see maybe where you could improve going forward for the next...
Yeah, there's kind of two strands to that, because we're a university, you know, the students are putting on productions, but they're putting on productions to be assessed on their abilities and their skills. So we write up assessments of them and then talk to them and say, OK, where did you feel you were in terms of your acting and your singing and your dancing and your professionalism over the whole process? And they'll tell us, and then we'll say, okay, we as teachers and as professionals think you were here, here, and here. And sometimes those match up, and sometimes they don't. And then there's another process where, you know, we as teachers and full-time employees of the school will get together and say, okay, what works well about that? And actually, what do we need to make sure we do better next time?
Sean has compiled his vast singing knowledge, putting pen to paper for his first book called Musical Theatre for the Female Voice, The Sensation, Sound and Science of Singing, which will be released in October this year.
I wrote the main body of it last summer. And yeah, like I said about Alice is teaching. There's the whole of the kind of the part one of the book is all about your physicality and what you need to, how you need to, or how you can build yourself up to sing from the ground up, from your feet up, so that posturally, structurally, everything is supporting your voice to do what it needs to do as you move through the ranges of singing, as you hit high notes, low notes, loud notes, soft notes on different vowels, all that kind of stuff. And then the second part of the book is all about the expressive side, about how you deal with words, like we were talking about that interpretation of lyrics, how you find meaning in everything and send that out to an audience. And those two are really two sides of the same coin. And it's specifically directed at female performers because I've taught a lot of young female singers, and in musical theatre, they have very specific challenges to address. And that's, you know, a lot of that is around the registers of their voice, how they move from their head voice to their mix to their chest, and how they belt, how they do those big sounds like you hear at songs like the end of Defying Gravity and Don't Rain on My Parade and things like that. That big kind of characteristic musical theatre sound.
How long have you been in the writing process for this book?
I wrote it over about 6 weeks.
Oh, wow.
I think because I'd been teaching, you know, it's everything I've been teaching for years. So I knew a lot of what I wanted to get down. I had to research it. I had to find published papers, you know, peer-reviewed papers or books that would support the arguments I was making on how to sing, because there's a lot of different ways of how to sing. And that's why there's that subtitle about the sound, sensation, and science, because that's how people have judged it. They've listened to singers and gone, I think this is happening. Or they've been singers themselves and say, I feel this. This is the sensation. So this is what's happening. Or they've looked at the science of it. You know, we've put cameras down people's throats, or we've put mirrors down people's throats and go, okay, this is exactly what's happening. So, yeah, I wrote it in about 6 weeks and I thought, well, I'll write it. I'll send it off. Maybe someone will publish it. Maybe they won't. If they don't, I'll see if I can publish it myself. And I sent it around to, I don't know, about half a dozen publishers, maybe a couple more. And two of them came back and said, yes, we're interested. Send us a bit more. And so I did that, and that process went on for a while, and eventually one of the publishers dropped out and said it's not for us, but Routledge said yes, we'd like to print this. And so it went to a peer review process, and that meant there was a little bit of rewriting. There's been some rewriting in the process since, but now we're at the stage where I've handed it over. The manuscript in its final form has gone. I don't really know what they're doing with it. They're doing something. I'm setting it to be printed, I suppose. So I'll get a proof copy, I think, at some point to read. It's all very new to me, this process. So I've just had to kind of feel my way through. But yeah, it's pretty much done. So yeah, it should be out in October.
Fantastic. That's exciting. And how did you go about finding the publishers? Did you know anybody that could help you with that?
I Googled. That was
Okay.
all.
Yeah.
I knew. I looked at current books on musical theatre, or books on theatre and musical theatre, and looked at who published them. So people like Nick Hearn Books, you know, who I think they do some great stuff. Obviously, Oxford University Press, Cambridge University Press, those kind of academic publishers, Methuen Drama, and all those. And and I just went on, and usually the websites have a list of editors of, you know, who does what, and you scroll down and you go past all the people publishing things on biology and chemistry and astrophysics and all that until I found performing arts and theatre, and then just dropped them an email and said, this is what I'm doing. Usually they have, often they had guidelines about what to include in that email in terms of maybe a sample chapter, maybe an outline of the book, who else has written something like your book? You know, what else is out there already? Because they have to be aware of that. And there's no point repeating what's already out there. And that was it. And you know, I just emailed them from there.
And when your book does come out, where can people find it?
So I think it should be available through Routledge, and I think it will be available on Amazon and platforms like that. It'll be available in hardback and ebook
Oh,
first,
awesome.
and then some point in the future, I think it's like 18 months down the line or something, it will come out in paperback, which will be much cheaper.
Yeah. And also, as well as a new book, you've just released or started a podcast with a couple of fellow lecturers at Anglia Ruskin University. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is great. So we the lecturer who runs the course, the musical theatre course, a chap called Ryan Murphy, he said to me and my colleague, Adam Gerbison, he said, you know, I think we should do a podcast, guys, because we used to sit around in the office and being all kind of musical theatre geeks, we used to talk about it and talk about different shows and songs and performers and things like that. He said, oh, I think we should, you know, do a podcast on this. And I was like, oh, do you think? I don't know. Does the world need another podcast? But yeah, he said, I think it would be a good idea. So we had a couple of practice runs towards the end of last year. And we definitely didn't release them because they needed a bit of polishing. And then we came back in January and we were like, okay, let's do it. We've got a studio. There's a studio attached to the university. We've got a little format. We do half an hour where we do, we talk about maybe something that's happened or, you know, maybe a show we've seen or something that's been released, something that's in the news about musical theatre, like when the new West Side Story film came out or something like that. Then we do a little segment called My Favourite Sings, where one of us talks about a favourite show or a favourite song and why and what there is to offer in that. And we hear a bit of the music involved. And then we do a quiz at the end where you normally have to guess the song, guess the musical theatre song. And it's been really good. It's been really popular with the students. We even got the students on because of we're having these productions. We had one week, we had our students from Urinetown come and have a chat about the show and how they were finding it. And then the following week, the second years came in. They were doing a musical called Bear. And we've just come back from a trip to New York where we saw lots of shows and the kids did lots of dance classes. I didn't do any dance classes, but they did dance classes. And we had an audition masterclass and things like that. And we've recorded a special episode from New York as well.
You've got a really good chemistry between the three of you. You make the musical theatre very interesting and fun, I think. Is that the sort of idea to try and, like, I guess you're sort of targeting people who are interested in musical theatre, but to maybe make it more accessible to people that aren't as familiar with musical
Thank you. Yeah, that's really kind. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We always want to have fun with it. We're not terribly serious people, so we wanted to come on and have a laugh and kind of rib each other a bit because that's how we are in the office and just bring some of that. And you know, we wanted to be informative and talk about you know, give people an insight into what's going on, especially, like you say, young people, especially young performers who are thinking of going into the industry or auditioning for higher education courses and things like that, and say, well, we think this is what works and what doesn't work, and this is why. And so that's the kind of vibe we went for. I mean, even the title of the podcast, which is Empty Chairs at Empty Tables, musical theatre fans will know that one of the most popular songs in Les Miserables is Empty Chairs at Empty Tables, and we're doing a little pun on that.
Yeah, I thought so it was a great name.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, when we tell people that. I came up with it. I don't want to toot my own horn, but yeah. Yeah, that normally gives them a bit of a smile, and that sets the tone. Like you say, we want to have some fun.
Is Les Miserables one of your favourites, or is it just because of that song?
I mean, it's a great pun. It's one of Ryan's favourite show. Our course leader is his favourite show. I mean, I like Les Mis, and it's a juggernaut in musical theatre terms. And I saw it recently, and it's an amazing show, and people love it. I went to see it, and you know, it was a standing ovation at the end, and it's been going for 40 odd years. So, yeah, it's a massive piece.
And what's your opinion on how the movie compares to the show?
So, I'll be honest, I haven't seen the whole movie. I've seen bits of it. And the bits that I've seen haven't made me want to watch the whole movie. So I think we all know that the singing came in for some pretty fierce criticism when the movie was released. And it is a show. I mean, I know the acting is obviously important as well, but so is the singing. They made a very strange decision to not, because of the way they've recorded it and added it to the film, there's no reverb, there's no sense of echo or anything on the singing. So it sounds really dry. It sounds really dry and a little bit dead. So even things like that would have helped. I'd like to see more musical theatre performers in these films of musical theatre shows. I know that I think it can work really well. I mean, I really like the Sweeney Todd film that was done with Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter. And they may not be natural singers, but they do a good job. and they sell the piece, and they act really well in it. So it can definitely be done. Maybe Les Mis is not the best example of a theatre to film musical.
What would you say that the best theatre to film musical?
Well, I think, like I said, I think Sweeney Todd did it really well. I think Into the Woods did a really good job that came out a few years ago, with Anna Kendrick and James Corden. I think that's great, and still a lot of the golden age of MGM musicals, things like Oklahoma and An American in Paris. Those films of shows have really stand up well. I think you have to change your medium. I don't think you can't just film a theatre production. That will definitely go wrong. But if you adapt it to the requirements of film, which is usually slightly shorter, there's no interval, you can play with your angles more and your axes, then it'll work well. Something like Guys and Dolls, I think, is brilliant and stands up really well. So there's definitely ones that have done it and done it effectively.
Alongside everything else that Sean is doing, he is studying at the University of Surrey.
I am taking a course in higher education, a master's degree in higher education, so that I have a better understanding of how we teach and how students learn, both on the micro level of in the classroom, one-to-one or in a group, and on the macro level of a university course over 3 years and all the modules that that involves. And that's been fascinating to me because I like education as well as apart from musical theatre. So to learn about that, to learn how people learn, has been really good for me, and it informs a lot of what I do. And I'm also doing a PhD with Anglia Ruskin, which will be about the audition process in musical theatre, and it will be about what kind of values are going on for an audition panel that lead them to giving a particular person the role. Because I feel as a performer, we go into auditions, we do our 3 minutes, we sing a song or 16 bars or 32 bars or something like that, and then we leave, and some days or weeks later we hear a result, either a yes or a no. Either way, there's usually very little feedback as to, what got you the job. And so therefore it's very difficult to plan and to teach students what they should be doing in those situations. So my plan is to go and interview a number of directors and musical directors who have extensive experience working in professional musical theatre, especially in the West End, and put to them questions like, okay, so what makes you decide? What are you looking for? How much does charisma count? How much does acting talent count? Are you worried about how much are you worried about someone's tuning? How much are you worried about their vocal technique? How much does the people already in the cast, matter as well? Because I think we'll find that some things are out of our auditionees' hands. If someone who perhaps is playing your brother or your father or your lover has already been cast, and you don't look right next to them, or your voices don't blend or something like that, you may not get the role. And that's nothing to do with your talent. That's just the circumstances. Or it may be that someone can come in and sing so well that you just can't not give them the job. And in which case, what is it about their singing that is that good, that other people should be aiming for?
We have landed in India. Let's hear what Sean has planned for his future and what he intends to do while in the second most populous country in the world. What are your plans for the future, Sean?
Well, we'll do season two of the podcast come September. This summer, I'm going to be going back to a bit of performing. I did a show called The Bo'sun's Mate, which was written by a woman called Ethel Smythe, who was a suffragette back in the day, and she even some of her music was actually used as the suffragettes' theme. And she wrote this wonderful little opera called The Bo'sun's Mate, which is quite feminist, and it's really fun, and it really works as a piece of theatre. And I'm going to be doing singing in that in the Arcola Theatre in August, and that's actually one of those that's one of these COVID gigs that's now come round again, because we were supposed to do it in 2020, and obviously that's when lockdown was happening and everything was cancelled. So it's finally come back. So I'm really looking forward to doing that. Might have some choral gigs coming up as well in London at the Royal Festival Hall, which will be great fun. And then I need to pick a show between me and my MD. We need to decide what show we're going to do come September, which will be very exciting. We usually do what we call a book musical, which is something that's very much story led. It's led by the script. So something like Oklahoma, Carousel, those tend to be those legit golden age kind of musicals, rather than something more conceptual like a chorus line or company. So I need to choose that. Be nice to see the book come out in October. If I need to do loads of PhD work over the summer as well. need to get cracking with that, otherwise my university will be asking questions saying, "Are you actually doing anything about this PhD?" So yeah, so I think that'll between the performing of sort of writing, researching, performing, directing, I've got plenty to keep me busy.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And when you get to India, what would you like to do? Apart, well, you doing the train journey, is there any particular route that you would like to do?
Well, I'd like to spend some time in the big cities like Mumbai. I'd like to go to those big spice markets, and see all the spices and some of the other markets, with fabrics and things like that. They've got such beautiful colors and patterns and designs and such great food. I'd like to wander around those and see what's what and taste and try stuff. And I'd like to visit the Taj Mahal, obviously, because that's the big thing that everyone wants to see. I think that would be a fantastic experience. And just go to a lot of different cities, and maybe I'd take some of the literature with me as well, so I could read that while I was there. I quite like doing that. That's a nice, gives you more of a feel of what's going on. I'm a big fan of Salman Rushdie, so maybe I'd take some of his work that's based in India and read that while I was out there. Just sucking up the history of it, the culture of it, the food. That would do me very nicely.
Sounds fantastic. Well, it was a pleasure to talk to you, Sean, and to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Kenneth. Been lovely to talk to you too.
That was Sean Aquilina, ladies and gentlemen. I hope this helped you through your morning or evening commute, lunchtime walk or run, or whatever you find yourself doing when listening to your podcasts. If you'd like to get a little more insight into India and find out whether Sean chose a window or aisle seat, head on over to my website, comeflywithmepodcast.com. And if you enjoyed this conversation, follow me at comeflywithmepod on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and comeflypodcast on Twitter to get further updates on the podcast. I have been your host and pilot, Kenneth Fairweather, and it was a pleasure having you on board. Safe travels, everyone. Change our